You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. In today's podcast, I talk about the great ice storm of 1998, which more than 3 million people lost power. And on Matron and Maiden, they bring you the lost arts of womanhood, and specifically they're talking about some recipes and managing chores in the home. For today's main topic, we're going to discuss the great ice storm of 1998. We'll talk about the basically the overview of it, what happened, the who, what, when, where, and why, and then some lessons learned. Now, this was a massive ice storm. It was really five smaller ice storms that kind of just combined to impact a really relatively small area. It basically the eastern side of Canada, so eastern Ontario, southern Quebec, and Nova Scotia, also down into the northeastern United States, from northern New York to central Maine. This was a massive ice storm, uncharacteristic for the time. These areas are all used to ice storms, but the accumulation was severe, and it caused widespread electrical power outages, failure of infrastructure, etc. All these types of things kind of came together, and it literally left millions in the dark for periods varying from just days to all the way into months in some instances. For most people, it was a couple weeks, but there were many up in Canada specifically that went without power for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, etc. 35 fatalities total, at least in most of the sources that I saw, and really a shutdown of large cities like Montreal and Ottawa, and it caused obviously just massive reconstruction effort, massive damage as far as monetary concern, and this ice storm actually even led to the largest deployment of Canadian military forces since the Korean War, and so all these things kind of came together and knocked out power. And so for one example, in Maine alone, Maine at this time, 1998, had a population of 1.2 million. I think over the period of the storm, 700,000 went without power for at least some period of time. That's just massive. And then in eastern Ontario and southern Quebec, it was even worse. The numbers were even higher proportionally. Maybe not the same numbers overall, but proportionally higher, just due to basically the collapse of the electrical infrastructure due to the ice. And so that's kind of the gist of what happened in 1998. It's called the Great Ice Storm. Some call it the North American Ice Storm of 1998. But I want to talk about a few lessons learned regarding this ice storm. So the first is that, you know, a lot of times I think we have a tendency to underestimate ice storms unless you live in an area where they're prominent. They'll knock out power, they'll drop limbs and trees, etc. Then you know how dangerous they can be. And so the first lesson learned is just to do an analysis of where you live. What is the likelihood of ice storms in your area? When was the last major ice storm in your area? What type of damage did it do, etc. So in this case, 3 million people went without power, like I said, ranging from days to months. That is massive. And we have to be prepared to go without power, and we're going to talk about that quite a bit through this. The next thing I want to consider here is human nature. Okay, and so in any situation like this, I like to say that we have this thin veneer of civility, or the thin veneer of law, where when it breaks down, it breaks down really fast. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to become a criminal, and that doesn't happen. And this is a good example. Lots of people helped their neighbors. Lots of people lent a hand to one another in many different ways, There was lots of compassion out there, neighbors helping neighbors, etc. There was also a lot of criminal activity. So there's a lot of theft in this type of thing. And we can see that in example after example after example. Hurricane Katrina comes to mind. When that thing breaks down, it can be a chaos. And human nature shows us that. And we know that, philosophically speaking, theologically speaking, we know that people are inherently bad. Okay, it doesn't mean that they can't do moral acts and those types of things. But from just a practical standpoint, you have to assume that people will do bad things. So that's an important lesson learned there. The next thing is a lot of these electricity poles, they took on loads 30 times their own weight. And this was the same thing with trees, and we'll get into that. A lot of the literally destroyed trees like crazy. Not so much in the forest, even the forest suffered 10 to 30% loss in trees. But a lot of your ornamentals, a lot of people who rely on trees for a living, they suffered even greater losses. And I'll talk about that here in a minute. So what's the lesson learned there? You need to be aware of your area around your home. You know, do you have any trees, any limbs that are in precarious positions that if there was an ice storm or something that a major windstorm or anything like that, if they drop, that they would be a hindrance or even worse, causing damage. And that's something that you can take care of ahead of time. Now is a great time to prepare for winter. Take a look. What trees do you have that would be threatening to your house? What limbs would be threatening to any access, any roads, etc., any limbs that would threaten power lines, those types of things. All things that you can take care of. It's either through calling somebody or perhaps taking care of it yourself. You know, and with that, do you have the ability in an ice storm to clear debris? Do you have a chainsaw? Is it working? When's the last time you started it or done maintenance on it? Is the chain sharp? Those kinds of things. All things that you should do now when prepping for winter. The next thing is that during this scenario in 1998, entire transmission towers that you think of with all the power lines crumbled literally from the weight of the massive amount of ice accumulation. Obviously, this caused major hazards. If those lines were still hot, in many cases they had already lost power. But that's something to consider big time. Now, again, I mentioned this earlier with human nature. We saw both good and bad with what people were doing in this circumstance. People were helping one another. Okay, and that's important, and you need to foster that now. So if you live in a neighborhood, you should be building community in your neighborhood, not because just in case an ice storm, you should do it anyway, but it sure does help out a lot when these types of things happen. Neighbors help one another in these situations if you work on this idea of community. Get to know them, talk about these things, even if they think you're crazy. They'll be coming to you if something like this happens for leadership because you had the foresight to think about these things. You know, on the other hand, people will look for victims. They will steal. They will steal generators. They will steal food. They will commit crimes. They will take advantage of the lawlessness that's created because the system is down. And quite frankly, emergency personnel, whether they're police or fire or medical, can't get everywhere. Whether the roads are blocked or there's just too much ice, and it just there's a lot of issues associated with this. And so your goal is to be a hard target. You don't want to be a soft target. In most cases, criminals are looking for a victim. They're not looking for a fight. Okay, so you be a hard target. You need to secure your stuff. You need to chain it down. But guess what? Chains aren't enough by themselves. Okay, a nice big pair of bolt cutters can take care of most chains easily. So you need to make it difficult. It might even require a physical watch. I mean, in this scenario alone, just in Quebec, I think within the first few days, there was reports of 50 generators being stolen. So these things will happen. When people get desperate, they will take stuff, and they won't care whether your family has to go without. So it might require a physical watch. So in that case, you might consider bringing over, and of course, this should be pre-planned, one or two families, you know, that you guys can hunker down together, can share the watch responsibilities that it may take to watch things like generators, because obviously you don't want to put them in your home or even someplace where it's going to get backfilled into your home. Okay, so you don't want it locked down in a garage even, things like that. In fact, we'll get into this here in just a minute, but a lot of the deaths that occurred were from carbon monoxide poisoning. But real quick on generators. So we talked about this. They can't be inside, obviously, but yet every storm, somebody dies from having a generator or some type of heating element or something like that inside when they're not supposed to be inside, and people die. With that, when's the last time that you started your generator? When's the last time you had maintenance done on your generator? Do you start it every month or every week in some cases? Fuel storage. How much fuel storage do you have? You need to have some, because as you'll see here in just a minute, in this scenario, fuel was controlled. It was actually even available to some degree, but not very much. And everybody was, of course, limited, which happens every single time. Fuel limits, so you don't want to be the ones waiting in fuel lines for hours and hours to get your 4 or 5 gallons. Okay, so what do you have in storage? It's pretty simple. You can do fuel storage in many different ways, but probably the simplest way is just to have however many you want, a handful of 5 gallon gas cans and stuff that you rotate through every month. So for example, if you had 6 5-gallon gas cans or 30 gallons of extra fuel, you could rotate through it every month. So you're taking one fuel can, putting it in your vehicle, filling the next one up, etc., just rotating through. So the oldest fuel that you would have would be 6 months old. Okay, and I still recommend that you would put in things like gas stabilizer and things like that for storage, even though it should be perfectly fine after 6 months. It's still a good idea. And also, you have to know what your if you just have a generator that you bought and you threw it in the garage, you're like, there I go, I'm good. It's in the garage. It's there for emergencies. You need to know how to operate it. You know how to start it. You need to know how to hook it up to your house. Or are you simply just going to run an extension cord in and be able to power one or two things? You want to be able to hook it up to your furnace if you have an electric furnace, etc. So you need to know what circuits it can be plugged into or it is plugged into. That kind of thing needs to be done ahead of time. As far as deaths were concerned from this great ice storm of 1998, a lot of them were carbon monoxide poisoning and hypothermia and fire, believe it or not. Well, actually, you should be able to believe that. That makes perfect sense. But carbon monoxide poisoning, get a detector, have it battery powered, because in a lot of cases what happened is a lot of these people, they don't normally heat with wood and things like that, but when the power went out, they started heating with wood, and they ended up using wood that wasn't seasoned, etc., and ended up dying from carbon monoxide poisoning. People died from simple things like candles being knocked over and starting to fire, those kinds of things. So you could be in freezing cold temperatures with ice everywhere and die from fire. Okay, there's simple things that you can do to make something like a candle very safe. And put it in something that where it's not going to spill and cause a fire to start. Make sure there's nothing around it that can catch fire easily. And if you have to, you again, people have someone on watch. This is probably one of the best things you can do, is have someone on watch. They can be watching the generator. They can be watching the fire, things like that. Of course, people died by hypothermia. You've got to get your core and keep it warm, okay? And one of the ways that you can do this is concentrate on one room in the house. So if you have a fireplace, for example, isolate that room as best as possible. So if you take blankets and sheets or whatever, block off some of the other areas, and even get plastic and duct tape, seal off windows to help insulate a little bit, doors, things like that to help maintain temperature in that room. Also, you have to have a way to heat water, if at all possible. Just by drinking, you know, hot water, this will help immensely with keeping your core temperature up. Falling ice, trees, things like that, all major hazards during this type of a significant ice storm. You know, one of the other aspects of this was a major threat to the livelihood of a lot of people. Never mind the fact that, you know, people just couldn't go to work for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, things like that. But people who relied on the land, whether they were, you know, there's a lot of sugar maple growers and farmers of all kinds, a lot of dairy farms, tree farmers up there. And a lot of them were devastated by this. A lot of their trees were destroyed. The sugar maples were hit particularly hard. 40 to 50% of them were lost. That type of loss is huge. The dairy farmers had to basically dump millions of dollars worth of milk. A lot of loss to animals as well, and just from being unable to get them water, things like that. And so there was a huge loss in animals. So are you prepared for your animals? If you have animals, are you going to be able to take care of them if something like a major ice storm occurs? An example, the maple growers, it took them almost 15 years to recover, to get back to where they were. For those that you know, you have a loss of 30-40% of your trees, it takes a long time to grow a sugar maple to where the point where it's putting out maple syrup. Okay, so one of the things that you can think of is, and this is kind of getting off topic, but developing multiple sources of income. You know, don't rely on one thing. Don't, if you're going to be a farmer or whatever else, don't monocrop. Come up with multiple crops or multiple streams of income. And this goes for somebody who works in an office as well. Do you have multiple streams of income? What if you lost your job? You know, what if the area was devastated so much that for whatever reason, your little industry went out of business? So have multiple sources of income. Do you have maybe a little side business on your own? Things to think about. One of the major things that came out of this, a lot of people talked about that they became overly reliant on one source of heat, and usually that was electricity. And from that, a huge lesson learned is many people said never again, and they developed multiple sources of heat. They had wood stoves installed. They had, you know, propane furnaces installed, things like that. So they developed multiple sources of heat, and that's a great idea. And I would recommend, if you're in a cold climate, you've got to have at least one wood heat source. And you have to be prepared to use it. And so, I mean, you should use it anyway. It's a great renewable source of heat if properly managed. But you need to make sure you have the proper kinds of wood. It's seasoned properly. You're not going out to all the trees that are falling over from the ice storm and trying to cut them up then and there with 1 or 2 inches of ice all over the tree, which many people had to do. And then they're taking wet wood in, trying to burn wet wood. You know, it's kind of a disaster. You know, there were several instances. Like one comes to mind. By day 9 of no electricity, they were out of wood. Okay, day 9. This is Canada in January, and they don't even have enough wood for 2 weeks. Okay, so that just shows you that, hey, they had a wood heat source. So they had a wood stove or a fireplace, whatever. And they only had about 9 days worth of wood. Okay, that is not enough. You should lay in enough wood to get you through the entire winter if you had to. That's what I would recommend. Another lesson learned from this is you can't rely on the phone system. All communication systems, in many cases anyway, were down. So there were lots of people who had no way to communicate with anyone. So you need to think about that. You need to have a primary, a secondary, and a tertiary way to contact people. Okay, or maybe your tertiary way is you can't contact them, but you're either going to meet them somewhere or you're going to shelter in place, and you know that's part of the plan, and you guys are going to have a 1 week place and time to meet. Okay, something like that. Any plan is better than no plan. Another huge lesson learned that I saw was a trend is people didn't have emergency kits. They didn't have enough food. They didn't have enough water. They didn't have radios, things like that. They had no way to heat up water. They were trying to use ice for their water. In Eastern Canada during this time, because of the loss of the infrastructure, they lost the ability to pipe in water. So they were almost immediately, within a day or two, they had no water. No water to flush toilets, no water to drink, etc. So people had to improvise. It brings me to the next lesson learned, is sheltering in place versus bugging out. You know, as this storm was approaching, many people just kind of gaffed it off, and they said, yeah, okay, it looks like it's going to be pretty bad, but we've gone through many of these before, and, you know, losing power for weeks on end just can't happen here. Okay, well, it did happen there, and a lot of people regretted not being able to leave. Okay, so you need to make a determination ahead of time. These are things you need to be thinking about, talking with your family about, and having a place outside of the local area that you can go to. And it obviously can't just be to your neighbor's house, although they may be much more prepared than you. So maybe that is a plan where you're all, you know, like I said before, two or three families go to somebody's house, and that way they can set up watches and help with all just the normal activities of life without power. It was much more difficult. The roads became impassable. Trees were down. Transmission lines were down. Cars wouldn't start in many cases because it was extreme cold. And so after the fact, they didn't have the opportunity to leave. So again, determine ahead of time what is your threshold. If you see a major storm approaching, why not leave and go to an area where it's not anticipated to go. Fuel stations. Fuel stations had half-kilometer lines. They were several hours in length. They were running low all the way on day five, and so they immediately put in fuel limits. I think it was about four or five gallons. So, you know, again, the lesson learned there is store some fuel, you know, at least 30 gallons of your own fuel. That'll really help, you know, get you through at least some period of time. Okay, but again, don't become one of these that has to immediately go into the lines. Overcrowded shelters, another lesson learned. All of the shelters were immediately overwhelmed, overcrowded with people who didn't have food, didn't have water, had no way to stay warm. You should have a plan. You should be able to either shelter in place or leave ahead of time, if at all possible. Try not to have to go to a shelter. That's just a terrible lack of planning. Although some people, maybe they just, for whatever reason, they couldn't. And so we should have compassion on them. But the more of us that are prepared, the better. Freezing pipes. Of course, you know, most people prepare, winterize ahead of time. They take care of, they'll insulate the pipes that are, that either are exposed or that, you know, that the ones that need to be insulated are insulated. But the reality is that these homes are becoming frozen practically themselves. And so water pipes were freezing and bursting even inside of homes because it was getting that cold. Either because they were abandoned, it was basically the same temperature outside as it was inside. Emergency equipment in the stores, and fortunately the stores were even open, so there was still some commerce happening. There was still basically some modicum of control. You know, it wasn't utter chaos. So after some time, when they were able to start clearing roads and things, there were stores open, but all the emergency equipment was all sold out. It was either, you know, sold out, or it was in, you know, very low supply, and you know, again they were limiting what you could buy, those kinds of things. You know, and the final point I have here is that, again, this is a very isolated incident. I mean, it was relatively large, don't get me wrong, but from the big picture, it is a narrow swath of land, just in the very eastern portion of North America, relatively small, and the entire rest of both Canada and the United States doing fine, watching football probably, and you had all this chaos going on over here. All right, so with individuals, they were having serious emergencies. You know, they were having their own little personal disaster. If you were sitting in your house with your family and you had no power, you could barely, you know, melt enough ice just to keep drinking water in your family, those kinds of things. This was a disaster for you. But for the rest of the country, they didn't even probably know it was occurring. Okay, so because it was isolated like that, there was lots of help. Okay, they were bringing in emergency supplies. They did have access to fuel, although, you know, small amounts. There was shelters for people to go to. You know, they still could go to the stores and get limited amounts of food, those kinds of things. Imagine if this was a lot more widespread. Imagine if it was the entire eastern portion of North America. It would overwhelm the system, and there would likely not be incoming supplies and those kinds of things. And so this would have been a lot worse. And so that what the major lesson learned here is that most people that went through this ice storm in 1998 were not able to make it. They had to go out, get supplies. They had to rely on a generator. They had to be able to buy fuel or food and those kinds of things. So we must be prepared, better prepared than this. That this is something that we owe it to our families to have a general sense of preparedness to handle something like an ice storm. So I hope that you will take some lessons learned from this. Take a look at your emergency kit. Come up with your own decisions. Where would you go if a major, what it doesn't matter what it is, a hurricane or an ice storm was descending upon your area? Is there somewhere you could go? And would you pre-plan that? Maybe it's just family that's a couple states over, and you say, hey, we're going to go on an early vacation this year.
Hi, this is Matron
and Maiden.
Journey with us
as we rediscover
the lost arts of womanhood. Okay, so today we're going to talk about that chore card system that we mentioned last week.
Yes.
Lindy had gone through some time of trying to set it up. It was, I guess, a lesson in homemaking. just trying to pass down how do you go about starting this and how do you go about managing a home. And I have a lot of this stuff already done, but I think it's a good practice for young ladies who are eventually going to have their own homes to learn how to do it.
Yeah. So you don't end up clueless when you're married.
Yeah. So you kind of know how to do things. So let's start out. Our first step that I told Lindy that she needed to do was to walk through each room of our house and make a list of things that need to be done and how often we would do them.
And this would include things like dusting for cobwebs, spot washing walls, washing windows, sweeping, vacuuming,
dusting, cleaning light fixtures, wiping doorknobs and switch plates, washing curtains, dusting blinds, organizing drawers,
cleaning out magazines, cleaning the refrigerator,
cleaning the oven and the stove and cupboards,
whatever else you can think of.
Yeah. So you try to be thorough, but the beauty of this system and the way I've set it up is that if you find something that you forgot, just make a card for it and add it to the file box. So the one thing that we do is a basic cleaning every week of our home on the same day.
Now that we're in a routine, we will be doing it every Saturday.
Yeah, and normally I've done it on Mondays. The thing is that we're so busy now, Monday through Friday, with just homestead, with the podcast, with other work, that it's not, Mondays aren't making sense anymore. So
yeah,
Saturday fits better into our schedule. So the things that we do on Saturdays are basic vacuuming, meaning we don't do edges or anything like that.
Just basic. And we do that about twice a week or as needed, since we have a dog, a cat, and we live in the muddy country with six kids.
Right. But normally everything else we have, we only do once. So like dusting, sweeping different rooms, spot washing floors,
dumping trash in the bathrooms, like cleaning the showers and the tub, wiping the outside of appliances, and so on.
Yes. And then on top of that weekly cleaning, we do these different chore cards, which we call our sector chore cards. Sector, just different people call them different things.
We call it a zone, which is fly lady.
Yeah, fly lady calls it a zone. The sidetracked home executives call it something else, I think. I don't remember right now, but, you know, these are basically just sections or parts or pieces or zones, sectors of your home.
Yes.
So what you need to do is break your house into these sectors or sections and do it in a way that makes sense for you.
You can break it up according to location, like the same floor, for example, or type of cleaning, like bathrooms all use the same tools, so that would make sense.
Or maybe you know that a particular person will be doing certain chores, so you can break it up according to that person.
Then assign each sector a color.
Right. And we buy colored 3x5 cards for this purpose.
Yes.
So that we've got different colors that can be used for different sectors.
And it's very nice.
Yes. And then on each of these cards, you're going to just write down the name of the chore. Okay. So it's like vacuum living room.
Mm-hmm.
And then any additional details that someone would need to accomplish the task. So for instance, if you're doing the detailed cleaning of a living room and it's the vacuuming part, maybe you want them to move the furniture. Okay. So you would write vacuuming living room. Step one, move furniture. So they understand that you want them to vacuum under the furniture. Maybe you want them to vacuum the furniture.
Yeah.
Again, say that. So they know what they're supposed to do. They know what it includes.
It also includes stuff like dusting. Tell them to remove everything off of the shelf to dust it.
Right. Because during our weekly dusting time, we don't move things off shelves. We use our feather duster and we dust around it. Mm-hmm. But in our in-depth cleaning, our sector cleaning, we will want to remove items off of shelves, maybe dust those particular items down and also dust underneath them so it really gets clean.
Mm-hmm.
So again, write details that are important for them to remember as they're doing this chore card. And then you also want to write the frequency of the task on the upper right-hand corner so it's easy to identify and see
when you're going through your cards.
Mm-hmm. And at the day of the week or month, you would like it to be done.
Right. So you're going to add that to the card.
Yes.
So maybe you want to have it done on Monday. Again, most of ours will be done on Saturday because of our busyness, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. There are some kids in the house that are not busy during the day, especially in the afternoon when school is done, that we can give them chore cards and they can be doing those things every Tuesday or every Wednesday. So write the day of the week. Or maybe you want it to be done like Sean goes through and does some maintenance checklists around the house, and he does that the first Saturday of every month. And so that would be a day of the month.
Mm-hmm. This is also helpful so too much time doesn't pass, or even too little, like between
your cleanings.
Yeah, your cleanings. So if you do a detailed, or if you even just dust on Monday, and then the following Monday,
you're supposed to do it. Maybe you forgot to write the day of the week, and it ends up getting done on Friday.
Yes, so that's 12 days.
Right, that's not actually 1 week, and that's not being done weekly. That's being done almost biweekly. So,
So
it's just important to write those details down. And again, the last thing you'll want to write on there is what tools that person will need to accomplish the task.
Yes, and that's very helpful so that when you're in the room ready to clean, you don't have to leave the room to go get the tools.
Right, because every single time I've ever done that, I've gotten sidetracked. I've seen someone who needed something, or someone's asking me a question, or maybe, you know, I go, oh, I didn't get a load of laundry in. This is going on in the kitchen. Oh, I forgot to do this. Just grab your tools you need, go in the room, finish the job.
Yes.
Try not to get sidetracked. And so if everyone knows what tools they need, they'll know what to grab, and they can cordon themselves off and get that job done.
Yes.
Now, you'll want to keep your cards organized in some fashion. There are several options to do this.
We keep ours in a file box with days of the week, the numbers 1 through 31, and the months of the year.
On Saturday, we go through and disperse the cards as well as the monthly cards that need to be done in the days of the week. So we take our weekly chores and we put them. So our Tuesdays we'll put in our Tuesday, and Wednesday we'll put in our Wednesday. And we look at our monthly cards and go, okay, so this week is the 3rd through the 7th. Here's the things that need to be done on the 3rd. Here's the things that need to be done on the 4th. And if 3rd is a Monday, we put it in on a Monday. Mm-hmm. So we make sure to disperse all those things out weekly so we know exactly what we're supposed to do every single morning, and we work our way through that week. Another thing that I've done in the past as a way to keep them organized is to keep them on a key ring according to my weekly cleaning and sectors, and then also in the order of the day I assigned it. I would just put the key ring on a hook that I had hung for that purpose, and then each day grab the card ring and complete that day's chores. But now that we have so many people doing the chores, we like to give them a card.
So that they can follow the directions and then return the card so I know it's been completed.
Right. And then we can look and see, okay, whatever child did this chore, we can go check on it to make sure it's been done correctly and then put the card back in the box. So it's just easier for us to keep a box right now.
But you need to find whatever works best for your family.
Right. However you can organize your stuff the best, and a system that you know that you'll use that. The key really is to use it and be consistent, because it will become a habit after a while.
And your house will always be clean.
Right. You won't have to worry about trying to play catch up at the end of a week or even the end of a month because so many things have gotten out of control.
Yes.
So I want to emphasize again the importance of including children in the upkeep of your home.
Remember, work is a blessing. They live there too, and most likely they'll be responsible for 3/4 of the mess.
Right. They'll be adults one day as well, and you want them to know how to keep their home clean, how to be hard workers, and how to be good stewards of what God has given them.
Keeping their rooms clean is a good first step, but common areas are important for them to clean as well.
Right. And this is why, one of the reasons why I have really worked diligently my entire life raising my children to teach them to work around the house, and why Lindy at 14 is learning really how to manage a home, how to organize chores, how to go about keeping a home clean, how to make meals, how to do meal planning. All of these things are important, and they're things that you want to equip your children with before they get married and not after.
Yes.
Okay. So speaking of that, Lindy, you're going to share with us your oven pancakes. Now, these are pancakes. Well, first of all, they're so much easier than pancakes, and they're so much more delicious. And they're things that I used to make. And then, Lindy, I don't know, I taught you, what, about 6 months ago?
Yeah, you showed me when we were still in Okinawa.
So probably 6 months ago, how to do it. And she just kind of took off from there. And now she makes them at least once a week and sometimes twice a week for breakfast.
And they're actually extremely easy and extremely delicious. And you'll find this recipe on Matron and Maiden section of the CourageousLifePodcast.com. So don't worry about writing anything down. I'm just going to go through the steps, and we use a blender for the part where they usually just mix it in a bowl. And I usually put the flour in first. So that's 2 cups of flour. And then I put 2 cups of milk. Then I put 2 tablespoons of sugar, followed by 8 eggs, and then 1/2 tablespoon of salt. And I blend that up, and you have to make sure to scrape things off the side and then blend it up some more.
Right, because the flour sometimes gets stuck on the side of the blender.
Yep, it always gets stuck.
So just push it off and re-blend so that all the flour is incorporated into the mixture.
Yes. And I forgot to mention, before you begin any of that, to preheat the oven to 500 degrees.
Yeah, 500 sounds kind of high, but it really cooks quick, and it makes it puff up. It just comes out perfectly.
It does.
So don't worry about the high temperature.
While it's sitting there, you want to take a 9x13 baking dish and put 5 tablespoons of butter in it. And then just stick that in the oven. Let the butter melt.
Yeah. It'll melt fairly quickly now that the oven is getting hotter. So just keep an eye on it so it doesn't get too browned.
Yes, because the other day I burned it.
Yeah.
And it was black.
Yeah, you don't want that. So just, you know, watch it. Don't walk away.
Yes. Once the butter is melted, you take it out of the oven and you pour the mixture from the blender into the 9x13 pan. And stick that in the oven. For our oven, it takes 14 minutes, but if your oven runs high or low, you really just gotta figure that out for yourself. So around the 10-minute mark, start checking it every minute or two.
Yeah. And when you pour the batter, make sure you're dispersing it across the 9x13 pan. Don't pour it all into one spot, and because then the butter will all pool up to the sides. If you disperse it across sort of like a zigzag pattern back and forth, the butter stays better distributed throughout the entire pan.
Plus, before it's cooked, it's quite thin.
Yeah, it's a very thin batter.
Yeah.
But it thickens right up and it puffs right up. And so you're looking for puffy and slightly browned.
Yes.
You don't want extremely browned. It's not like toast. But you want a little bit of brown on there. Now, we serve ours usually with berries.
Yes.
That we've heated, like a berry compote or
berry syrup.
Berry syrup.
We've put sweetened condensed milk.
Sweetened condensed milk with sliced strawberries.
And then we once had it with powdered sugar
and butter.
Some butter and even whipped cream.
Yeah.
You can really put anything on it. And also, when you take it out of the oven, don't expect it to be really cake-like. It should be almost like a thick crepe, since it's so high in egg. It's basically almost the texture of an egg. So it's crepe, not cake.
Crepe, not cake, yes. So it is easy, it's delicious, and we will have that recipe up on our website by this evening so that you can check it out and make it for your family. It serves 8 to 10 people depending on, you know, size of their appetite. For us, we've got 5 teenagers.
Yeah.
In the house. And then we have a toddler who eats like a teenager. And then we have 2 adults. So yeah. We usually end up with 1 piece left. Lindy cuts it into 9.
Yes, I do cut it into 9. And the pieces don't look very big, but they are extremely thick and they're very filling.
Yeah.
So everybody is full and there's still a little bit of leftovers.
Yeah. So it's a great meal and I hope you try it. And if you do, let us know and let us know how it turned out. You could even post pictures and tag us on Twitter or on Facebook.
Yep.
So that's it for today and we will see you next time.
Our scripture from today comes from Proverbs chapter 27, verse 12. A prudent man sees evil and hides himself. The naive proceed and pay the penalty. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We would appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria. Thank you.